This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, May 18th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. In local, state, and sometimes federal regulations, a permission-based market has replaced a freewheeling one. And it's actually worse than that, according to Will Reinhardt of the Center for Growth and Opportunity. He says the discretion given to regulators creates too many ways for the state to veto transactions and new enterprises. And finding ways to dramatically curtail this vetocracy should be top of mind for lawmakers. We spoke last month in Las Vegas. So for those of you who weren't listening when we weren't recording,
obviously,
Will and I were trying to come up with a pithy term that beats Francis Fukuyama's vetocracy.
Vetocracy.
And the term vetocracy refers to what?
The term vetocracy refers to this tendency in our institutions to have overlapping veto powers. What we've seen rise, especially in the last 10, 20 years, is that it's really easy to say no. The best example that I can think about that about this is this recent UC Berkeley kerfuffle where one guy said he did not want any new people coming into Berkeley, so he stopped the entire school from expanding. He stopped a massive school expansion over this issue. He just didn't want more people in his Berkeley neighborhood. So he filed a request under CEQA and was able to stop the entire process.
CEQA?
CEQA being the California Environmental Quality Act. It's their version of the Environmental Protection Act that they have at the state level.
And that effectively allows almost anyone in the state to prevent any development.
To prevent any development, yes, if they want to. So it provides this massive power to individuals who want to go in front of a judge and say, hey, this project does not align. I'm giving you all these reasons why. And, you know, a lot of them don't have merit. But it allows for these kind of entrepreneurs, right? These policy entrepreneurs, these people in a bad kind of entrepreneurial way to go in and stop projects. And we've seen this happens a lot. This California Berkeley is an example of this. There's examples in healthcare, you know, beds getting stopped from being built. There's countless examples of this sort of problem.
Well, the example you pointed to earlier was Patrick Quinlan, who tried to get, he's 77 years old now, I guess.
77 years old, yeah.
He tried to get approval for 10 new units of housing on a 17,000 square foot lot in San Francisco.
Yeah, a third of an acre, basically.
And the punchline is,
so Patrick Quinlan took 40 years to get 10 units of housing built in San Francisco.
And in those 40 years, what happened to housing prices in San Francisco?
A lot. The price changed dramatically. It's kind of dark, but two of his investors actually passed away in the ensuing 40 years. There was a whole group of these people who were trying to do this development. And so the majority of them actually are no longer living. There was a group of three, if I recall correctly. So he's the only one that's actually left. Everyone else has died in the interim time period. There is a woman, Kathleen Campbell, that really, I think, exemplifies, unfortunately, this problem. She said that the project was the best project, the best version of the project that she had seen in something like 22 years. And that
the best version of this exact 10-unit development.
This 10-unit development. And this is an endemic problem. I mean, California is the foil, and California is the most egregious and often the worst examples of this problem of vetocracy, which again is just a broad term for these kind of overlapping veto players within political institutions and permitting institutions in particular.
Okay, so and perhaps this is bigger than land use, I would imagine.
Yes, it is.
But you know, in that context, we're talking about government officials or people who have delegated powers from the government being able to put an X next to an idea and essentially either stop it in its tracks or slow it way down.
I think there's two ways to think about the biggest parts of vetocracy. One group that's really important here are these policy entrepreneurs, if you want to call them that. It's not the best word for it, but I think it's probably the most descriptive. So there are these third parties that are basically coming in and saying, hey, you're going to stop this development. I'm going to use this Environmental Protection Act, or I'm going to use, you know, a whole range of different acts to slow this development down. So that's one side, the kind of the policy entrepreneurs. And then the other side that I see it is there's this other sort of kind of related problem happening within government, which is that it takes more and more permits to get to a building. So they're really, I see the two of the same thing. You're slowing down the process. You're making permitting in land use and housing and telecommunications and in quite literally all these kind of like hard infrastructures that there's this entire thing that's happening. Everything's being slowed down because there's many more voices at the table. Some of those are needed, I think, obviously, but a lot of it's gone too far. And I think that we really need to consider more fully how to reform these systems, how to change all of this. I've got my own ideas, and I think there are some good examples that exist out there, but there's a lot that's going on here that I think that we're not paying attention to all too often.
So outside of the land use context, what about a regulatory sandbox? And I mentioned that specifically because, you know, inside of a land use context, those land uses would be ongoing. There's a lot of upfront investment. But in terms of being able to offer a service mm-hmm. or a new product, it would make sense for certain products that have no clear public health or safety implications to be able to just move forward, and we can worry about the regulatory state later.
Regulatory sandboxes, I think, are a great example of the way to deal with the problem of vetocracy. And there is a clear issue here with products as compared to land use or infrastructure, which can be solved through sandboxes. And there's a Utah, I know, has been developing a lot of this. Regulatory sandboxes are, I think, one of the ways to deal with this sort of problem.
Describe what that is.
Yeah. So a regulatory sandbox, at least in this context, allows for a certain period of time, typically 18 months to about 2 years, for these products to not be regulated or mandated to be regulated in a certain kind of way. So it's kind of a little bit esoteric, but the kind of clear example are, you know, a lot of new financial services or financial products that are coming out. You know, you think about like Robinhood, for example, and that has a sort of a, oftentimes, if I recall correctly, those have a sandbox carve out in a lot of states to allow them to operate. So we're talking a lot about financial services in particular for regulatory sandboxes. At least that's where a lot of development has occurred. But that idea that services and goods should be able to go out into the market and shouldn't necessarily be subject to all the same regulatory approvals that you would have if you're a complex institution or a financial institution, those sorts of ideas, I think, are still helpful in this broader vetocracy problem, which we see is just that there are too many extra steps to these processes of getting a house built or getting a new business started or getting something, you know, getting new infrastructure built. Those are very expensive things that we need to be able to do cheaply and quickly.
So in terms of trying to maybe flip the burden of regulation onto regulators to provide very good reasons for stopping a project, whatever it is, be it a project involving land use or not, what about just a time limit?
A shot clock. Yeah, a shot clock, 180 days. You have 180 days to either say yes or no. That's one of the other suggestions that I have. So a shot clock has worked pretty traditionally within telecommunications and broadband deployment. This is an idea that I see has been actually quite successful in the telecommunications communication space in particular. And I think that idea can be more broadly applied. You have some sort of limitation on when you can bring a disapproval or something that would potentially stop the project. Those sorts of ideas, you know, a shot clock, something where you have like a carve out, I think those are probably the two most successful real world examples of it. There's a whole bunch of more theoretical things that we could probably do. I'm a little bit less convinced of those sorts of ideas, but the shot clock, some sort of limitation. So shot clock, a limitation is one of the ideas, the regulatory sandbox, and there's a couple ways you can structure a regulatory sandbox. The other thing that I think should be considered is how do we understand people who are bringing these sorts of cases? These people, you know, a great example for San Francisco is this one guy, Ryan Delk, who is just a guy that lives in San Francisco, mentioned that effectively there's only six or seven people who stop all residential and building within San Francisco itself. And I live in Washington, D.C., and there's one guy that goes and opposes everything. If you live in D.C., he's the TENAC guy. You know, he's this tenants' rights individual who constantly is putting up flyer and literature. He's going to every single meeting. It's those sorts of individuals, which I don't know how you would potentially limit their ability to influence these meetings, or try to restructure it so that those individuals don't have an outsized voice. And one of the big benefits of COVID, you know, again, lots of detriments, obviously, to COVID. One of the big benefits to COVID has been that through the opening up of you know, city meetings and city planning meetings, that allowing this to actually go online, that they're hearing from new voices. They're hearing from people who are actually YIMBYs, right? That want development. And so they're hearing a very different sort of voice that is actually happening, or they're hearing very different voices now, and have been over the last 2 to 3 years because of what's happened with COVID.
Continuing on with the land use context, we associate restrictive zoning with local communities and not so much with like state regulation. And my thought has been, well, what if you make the zoning or the approval process hyper local, which is to say, for a housing development, anyone who owns property that touches this property, they sign off on it, good to go.
Hyperlocal is another idea that's being suggested, particularly in England. This is, I don't know about this area as well as I know about others.
This is just off the top of my head.
But you're exactly right. This question of local voice is something that I am just now getting into with this project, but I think it's also another key component. And the problem that you often see within land use, and particularly residential development or building, you know, building more homes, is that you have these individuals who are able to stop the process. And by narrowly restricting it with a hyperlocal zoning, the idea is that you would have some sort of benefit, you know, that the voices that are impacted or the people that are impacted the most would be the only people that can actually stop the building of these projects. That might be helpful, but the question that I really have is, how big is that line? And that's oftentimes a concern of how you actually develop and structure these sorts of, you know, these are the rights, these kind of local rights. This, I think, is a little bit more hypothetical. And again, there has been some development in the UK along these lines, but I'm not as well versed, at least in this space, and haven't seen as many real world applications as compared to the shot clock and the regulatory sandboxes, which actually seem to be pretty effective at allowing for new businesses and new development to actually be put into the ground and to be started. And I think those are just a little bit more practical rather than the kind of narrow limiting of zoning rights.
So aside from shot clocks and regulatory sandboxes, which again, regulatory sandbox we've seen in Utah, and
there's some in Tennessee, in Nebraska, if I recall correctly, Arizona has another big project. There's a lot of states who have done a lot of interesting work in this.
Okay. So what have we seen so far?
So the biggest benefits, the biggest wins in this regulatory sandbox space have typically been within the financial services communities. A lot of new electronic transfer technologies have also been supported by this. I think that we're still waiting to see the super big benefits of these projects, because again, most of these bills are at this point only 2 to 3 years old. You know, there have been, again, a lot of successes within these kind of financial services, but my sense is that those services probably would have been differently regulated regardless, that they exist in a different space. You know, they might not have physical locations, that all of the things that made the regulatory sandboxes beneficial, or at least work in the context of financial services and, you know, and Uber and Lyft and all of the, you know, the ride sharing service or our ride sharing platforms, all of those sorts of new technologies probably are very different than what we see in the traditional transportation and infrastructure and housing. So bringing the regulatory sandbox idea to the more traditional or the, you know, the hard infrastructure space, I think is still a big gap that needs to be done. There's a lot of research that I think still needs to be applied here, and to actually think through critically how, for example, NEPA would be, or this is the National Environmental Protection Act, how it could, you know, how it could have certain kinds of exemptions. You know, there's a lot of work, I think, that still needs, fundamental work that still needs to be done here in policy analysis. And I really hope that listeners will actually try to work on this. My colleague Eli Dorado has done a lot of really good work in the space of permitting reform, and honestly, I just think that there needs to be a lot more done, because this is a, you know, this is a topic that keeps on coming up over and over again. And honestly, I was thinking about this recently, that, you know, it's low hanging fruit, but low hanging fruit is sometimes the hardest fruit to see.
Will Reinhardt is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity. We spoke last month in Las Vegas. Subscribe to and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.